Today's show is brought to you in part by Third Wave Water. Do you ever wonder why the coffee you make at home never tastes as good as it does in the coffee shop? Here's the secret. Coffee shops spend thousands of dollars to make the perfect water for making coffee, and now, for as little as 10 cents a cup, you can work that magic at home. Third Wave Water has a patent-pending formula of minerals that, when added to a gallon of distilled water, makes coffee brewing magic. Recently, at the U.S. Brewers' Cup Championship, the first and second place finishers brewed their coffee with Third Wave Water. It's that good. Check out their website at thirdwavewater.com and use promo code HARDCORE for 10% off your order. That's thirdwavewater.com, promo code HARDCORE. Hello and welcome to a special 50th episode of HardcoreGaming101.net's Top 47,858 Games of All Time podcast, where we objectively, definitively, and scientifically rank the games you nominate. My name is Xerxes, and I'm calling you out, Knuckles. I see you chuckling. Don't think we don't know. My panelists and nominators today are...
I'm Bobinator.
Satango.
I'm Carl.
And once again, it's Jeff the Electric Viking.
On this podcast, we have three rules. Rule number one, all rankings are final, official, and scientifically accurate. Rule number two, you can nominate one game via five-star review on iTunes or Stitcher. We've stopped accepting nominations via Twitter for the foreseeable future, but look forward to an upcoming happy hour month of hours in which you can nominate games on Twitter. Rule number three, you can nominate games that have already been nominated. Just don't nominate games we've already ranked. See for yourself which games have been nominated and which games have been ranked and where they were ranked. Check it out, bit.ly/47kgames. All right, so the next game we're going to be talking about is Krull, which was nominated by @ElectricViking, and it was developed and published by Atari for the Atari 2600. Earliest release date and territory is sometime in the magical land that was 1983. So this is a licensed game, is it not? It's based on some kind of movie film for theaters?
Yes, is based on the single greatest film ever made. Crawl.
Hey, hang on. You sure not talking RoboCop here?
RoboCop. Jesus Christ.
You hipster son of a... I'll give you this plateau for now, but we'll come to blows later.
So Tanga, I am legally not allowed to be a hipster because I'm about to talk about Krull, okay?
All right.
Ain't nothing hipster about Krull. Or the game adaptation of it.
Games, yes.
Correct. This was... there was kind of a... similar-ish version developed in parallel by Gottlieb, I believe.
So what made you decide to pick the 2600 version, not the arcade version, a curiosity?
Well, I hadn't played the arcade version as a major part of it. The other reason I chose the 2600 version of Krull is because it is, A, I think the first 2600 version game we've covered, and B, it's fucking Krull, mate. Like, what do you want? Like, it's a game based on a movie where... a man gets a magic throwing star with the help of the guy who plays Thufir Hawat and fights a giant disembodied head at the end, which is a nice throwback to Zombie Nation, I guess, in a weird way.
Wow, continuity.
Yeah, he's not really a disembodied head. He has a body, I guess. Krull's a strange film, and I love it. It's one of the... it's like an example of an absolute like box office bomb that just spent like damn near $50 million getting made and lost about two-thirds of that. In box office receipts. It's,
did you say raised a sharp bone boomerang star? Sold. Greenlit.
Yeah. I cannot believe they spent the amount of money they did on this film, excepting for the fact that I think... well, so the scuttlebutt for years was that this was initially going to be Dungeons & Dragons the movie. Gary Gygax apparently at some point later in his life said that he had never been contacted in his capacity as the guy who made Dungeons & Dragons from anyone making Krull about, like, hey, could we make this a D&D film? So that's apparently bunkum. But there's a sort of, like, weird advanced D&D, like, early second edition vibe to everything in this film. It's like a weird mix of, like, low fantasy kind of Favre and the Grey Mouser meets, like, Spelljammer vibe, where you've got, like, castles and kings and horses and deserts and aliens with laser muskets invading. The entire fiction is nuts. I kind of want to go back and find like every version of it that's ever been made. I just want the Betamax version of it and the Laserdisc version. I want everything.
You made me want to go see it, so success there.
Yeah, it's a very interesting, like, visual aesthetic they went for. Like, again, like I like things that go for an aesthetic, and it's definitely not consistent, but they went for something.
Let me ask you this. How are they on the weird hat factor?
Not a lot of hats.
Really?
Yeah.
Because that's kind of a mainstay of these, like, sword and sandal barbarian type.
The only real hat I can think of is actually worn by none other than Francesca Annis, a.k.a. the Lady Jessica from Dune, which leads into my other point about Krull, is between that and an appearance from the aforementioned Freddie Jones, who was Thufir Hawat, as Ynir the Old One, it's kind of a tech rehearsal for Dune. God. Also features a very, very young Leslie Nielsen and Robbie Coltrane.
You mean Liam Neeson, not Leslie Nielsen.
Liam Neeson, god damn it, yes.
Yeah, Leslie Nielsen was already an old man at that point.
I've been drinking. So anyway, Krull, you should watch the film.
Before you get into this, let me I'm going to describe the game that I played.
Please.
And you're going to explain to me how that relates to the movie, because I haven't seen the movie. The game is one of these classic, you know, Atari 2600, like, I guess, two-stage or like, different segment type games.
Four so screens, segment, I think it is.
Yeah,
the first segment is you're like on a kind of field, and there's like a castle at the top, and there's a, I guess, a woman next to you, and you like start walking forward, and then you get, and then the woman gets knocked back, and then a bunch of dudes come out, and I guess you're supposed to, you're attacking them. And then when you lose that, you go to like a giant spider web. So at what point in the movie does that happen?
This film starts with basically a political marriage between kingdoms on a planet who are uniting after like years of fighting to fight off a kind of vague alien menace. First screen. Okay. So it's the wedding, and then aliens show up, and the aliens have laser guns, and you have like a sword. So, okay. All right. The first screen is just basically a screen to build up points for no particular reason, because as far as I know, you don't gain lives at any point, so it's just kind of a score attack thing. Between that and the spiderweb scene, there is riding across a field, which is supposed to be, like, about 40 minutes of the film, basically, which accounts for, like, leaving the castle, meeting, like, the Obi-Wan Kenobi figure, who is the guy who is Thufir, finding the glaive, which happens in, like, a lava pit in a mountain. Eventually, you wind up in the web scene, which actually is not the main hero. It's Thufir Hawat in the film, maneuvering across this, like, cocoon, web-infested cavern to go talk to, like, an old version of Lady Jessica in what would be, like, the white rectangle at top of the spider web in the game. So
I forgot to mention the white rectangle.
Yeah, the white rectangle at the top is where Lady Jessica is, but she's not Lady Jessica. She's another character.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, so you solve the puzzle of the spiderweb cocoon scene, which leads to kind of a reverse motion version of the horse screen two, let's call it, to get to the final boss, is basically kind of an alleyway or Yara's Revenge kind of thing.
This is our first Atari 2600, Atari VCS game that we've ranked, I believe. Mm-hmm. Although we did rank Zookeeper, which is the one of the most VCS-esque of early arcade games. But that one's really, really good. Yeah, go ahead.
Talk real quick about my thoughts on this game.
Sure.
I do find this game pretty technically impressive. I mean, it's an Atari 2600 game that has multiple levels. I mean, that's a pretty nice achievement on its own. It's got a title screen. It's got what you could technically consider a boss fight. So, I mean, those are all pretty nice to have for 1983. But really, what really kills it for me is the web screen, because that's pretty much where I just lose all my lives without fail, because it's really hard to figure out what exactly you're supposed to do at first, and even then, it's really hard to actually move around due to the way the webs move and push you back.
I mean, you could read the manual.
Yeah, so Cal's been hitting me off the head with this, but the manual does just basically explain that web scene pretty well. Basically, you just need to get to the top of the web, get to the white rectangle, whereas Lady Jessica is hiding, and a little beacon will start blinking on the web, and you just get Thufir Hawat to the blinking white light and just keep, like, moving the joystick in that direction, and you will maneuver back to screen two and ride your horse to the castle wherein the final boss is, unless the day has ended and the new day has started, at which point you need to go back. Because, by the way, there's a day-night cycle in this game that's indicated in the top of the screen. There's, like, a lot going on in this game.
There's way more than needed to be going on, which makes it a very impressive movie license title.
Yeah, that's a why kind of. There's a lot going on, but why?
I'm actually wondering if there are, in terms of home console games, like games with functional day-night cycles. I don't know if it's a day-night cycle, but it's definitely a day cycle. Time is progressing.
Does that tie into the movie at any point? Is there some sort of shifting daytime thing?
Like, they need to get to like the location of the villain, who's just called the Beast. His castle moves every day. So Thufir goes into the web. Lady Jessica is like, oh yeah, the castle's over here now. And they're like, shit, we have like 5 minutes. We need to get on these horses made out of fire and ride them across like the sky, basically, to get to this castle and get inside of it and kill aliens with a glaive.
This is a good movie and a good game. You know, both of these things sound
Krull
awesome.
Is such a good movie. Mm-hmm. Guys, Krull's really good.
I don't think I made clear that I actually have seen Krull before, and I'm going to lay down a hot take. I like Don Coscarelli, but this film is objectively better than The Beastmaster. I had to get it out there, you know, just in case there's a nice little objective comparison. But as for the game itself, I do like it, even though like 80% of the time you spend is in the giant web screen. And I do have to ask, why'd they make everything so obnoxiously bleepy on that level?
Yeah, the sound is rough, and the platforming over the... For those of you, let's paint a word picture. Picture a spider web drawn in, like, you know, Atari graphics, and then on top of that you've got kind of moving white bands that are sort of expanding in like European quotation mark patterns that you need to be jumping over, and the platforming is just not up to the task of doing this, basically.
Well, it tries to have like some sort of like pseudo physics-y wave sort of thing going on. There's like,
yeah,
is it?
Yeah, and if you get caught up in there, it basically will just push you back to the outer edge of a screen, and that's a timed sequence as well. So in the top right, you've got a hourglass dripping down. If that hourglass drips down, a spider just murks you in about 5 seconds. So you got to be kind of on your shit in there, or it will go bad for you.
But it's just an Atari 2600 game. This is pretty reasonable. Like,
this game, if you were to play through it perfectly, is about 3 minutes long, tops. Like, if you execute everything perfectly, you will literally finish this game in no more than about 3-4 minutes.
To be fair, you're not really meant to finish most Atari 2600 games, because they're all about the score.
Yeah, this is accurate. So having something you can finish 3-4 minutes with someone who likes to finish things, that's kind of neat. You know, it's like... Yeah. I actually haven't, because the last boss is kind of a son of a bitch.
Well, you have to collect glaives, right?
Good at games. Yeah, so this is leads me to the other problem. Like, I think the spiderweb sequence sucks. It's pretty rough. Even when you play it on the first of four difficulty settings where the webs just aren't moving at all, still isn't great. The other thing that sucks is the screen two, which again repeats twice. As you're riding horses, you will ride over glaives and little dudes in the ground who are like extra lives. They're like the Mega Man heads, but they're totally random. So you could have a sequence where you're playing through this game and wind up with no extra lives and one glaive, or you could wind up with one extra life and two glaives. But it's a quick time event. So as you're riding over these icons, you've got like a fraction of a second to hit the only button on the Atari controller to pick up either of these items. And if you don't, that sucks. Too bad.
And for me, most of the time, it didn't really work. I thought I was hitting the button time, but I guess I won, because I can grab anything. So like,
yeah, this
one glaive.
That was my problem, too, is I think it's kind of a shitty quick time event. Like, it is. It's a quick time event, and it sucks. The net effect of that is you can get to the final boss with a glaive and like three lives. What you're meant to do with this glaive is throw it at a wall and effectively play again, like kind of Arkanoid or Alleyway or something, and break through this wall, have the princess come out through this wall, land in you, on you, and give you the ability to throw a fireball into a boss who is kind of moving between you and this container the princess is in, kind of like Yar's Revenge-ish, but like reverse Yar's Revenge. But if that glaive misses the wall, you fail to catch it as it bounces back or it hits the boss, it's gone. And then you've got no glaives and like three lives. It sucks.
Yeah, it's hard, but it is doable. I have actually done it before, but it will take you like, I don't know, at least 20 tries to really get everything down pat. Thankfully, this game being as short as it is, I mean, I am impressed that this does have a definitive ending to it back before... like Super Mario Brothers was a thing. I mean, this game's pretty technically well put together. Just kind of hard to actually play in some respects. Also, I love when you go down the wrong way. You go down the castle the wrong way. You totally screw exiting the web sequence. And then the horses just, like, stop midway in before they turn around. It's like, ah, crap. And then you lose a life automatically somehow.
It plays one of the two pieces of music in this game, which is the bridal entrance theme, like the first four notes of it. And then effectively you suck gone. Like you get da 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 da, or you get
very, very Atari type thing.
Yeah.
Not ever getting the Pitfall 2, sadly. That game has some actually legit good music.
It's a relatively late actual life of the 2600 game. You know, I think it's not too far removed from something like Return of the Jedi in terms of, like, they certainly did cram a lot of ideas into this card.
Yeah.
And I think they got a lot of mileage out of the Krull film and the incredible plot therein.
I'm one of those people who has played a lot of early 80s Atari 2600 licensed games, and I can say that a lot of them are like that, where they break up the game into different segments, because that's basically the only way to squeeze additional gameplay out of it. Yeah. And sometimes I feel like Atari developers would do that because they felt like, well, if the kids don't like this one, they'll like this one. They don't like the spider, they'll like the horses. They don't like the... So I don't...
Well, one of these kids loves the Speedo game.
It's
funny every time.
One of the things about the Atari 2600 is to remember how technically deficient the system was. It had almost
nothing.
It was basically made to play Pong. Like, it's like they took something that was supposed to play Pong exclusively and somehow just broke that thing to make it do other things, which means...
It's what Jeremy Parrish keeps coming back to. It's like the Famicom was designed to play a good game of Donkey Kong. And yeah, the 2600 was designed to play a good game of Pong. And that's really about it.
Yeah, so the problem was, of course, is that basically you had to reload the screen to put more shit in the game, basically. So they went, well, if you have to reload the screen make it a new game, because that's the only thing that we can really do.
I think it's interesting because that's something that, although arcade games did sometimes do that, like Tron, I guess, has like different modes, or was Tron the one that they just split it up into different games, I think, entirely? Because there's like the light cycle game and the discs of Tron.
I think that Tron is split up, but there's several shmup type games that have, there's always the bonus game in way, like tons and tons of early 80s games have like...
Well, like, for example, there's a game based on the TV show MASH.
Yeah. Hey, my brother played that on an early computer where it was like, it actually had a few voice clips, and if you like blew it on surgery here, you win a few, you lose a few.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, here's how MASH worked, just to give you an idea of what these games are like, what you can expect. MASH is a two player, competitive game. It's either you versus the other player, you versus the computer, and you are in a race on the first screen, a race to pick up the most number of wounded people and bring them back to your hospital. And then once that segment ends, you've got an interstitial segment, which is like, it looks like it's kind of like the board game Operation, where it's got like a little like tubby dude in kind of profile or silhouette rather. And then instead of innards, he's got like some kind of weird maze etched into his body. And you navigate the cursor over and find the bullet. And then you have to pull the bullet out by going through the maze without touching the walls. So to say that, like, just so we don't get off, I'm not saying that like Krull isn't innovative or anything, but like this is kind of a normal thing that a lot of games were doing at the time. And I think we can judge, it helps us look at Krull in context, because it stayed, I think, like, you know, the bullet pulling out thing is interesting, but it's not really like much of a, you know, it doesn't feel like a game unto itself. Whereas for an Atari game in 1983, like the spiderweb thing, that in 1979 would have been an entire game, you know? So to us, it seems like nothing, but at the time, that would have seemed like to play like, oh, it's like a whole different game. And, you know, and the horse thing was like its own game and stuff like that.
Certainly, like the intro and the outro of the game, the wedding segment and the boss segment, you know, they're both like, you know, they're close enough to, you know, you could say Breakout or Space Invaders or anything like that. Like they all have that kind of.
Well, we were comparing it to Yar's Revenge. I mean, Yar's Revenge is just the Yar's Revenge thing.
Yeah.
It's the big, that's all it is. You don't like beat that stage and then you go on to a different kind of Yar's Revenge.
I guess the question is if it's better have one scene that's done particularly well, for it's better just try to go for a bunch of things and hope one of them works, like Kroll did.
When it came to the 2600, yeah. It was very difficult for the games to be anything but okay. You can tell me that the 2600 has great games on it, but certainly for the time, you know, when you got the Atari 2600, your choice was the Atari 2600, or really, like, a couple other systems that were kind of similar, but not...
Electric.
Yeah, like, I mean, I get it, you know, like...
Magnavox Odyssey 2.
When your choice is, like, of that minimal, then this is, you know, these machines kicked ass, but most 2600 games, they're not really great by any modern...
I don't know, I mean, if we were to get to ranking this game... If Yara's Revenge were already on our list, this would be well below it. Like, and that is a one-screen game. actually, yeah. I think Death Star Battle, Return of the Jedi, I think I would put that above Krull as well.
That was a great game, surprisingly.
That's, you know, two screens, I think. Some of the best games of the time, I think, were effectively one-screen games. Like, River Raid is a one-screen game. Enduro, right. Basically, is a one-screen game.
Flak Attack, one-screen game.
Pressure cooker?
Thing is, I don't really want to be that harsh on this game, because there's ambition, there's a effort, they were trying to do something really expansive and cool, I'd say.
Yeah, considering the law of averages on licensed titles, even today, this one is still decent for a licensed game.
Yeah.
You gotta wonder whether Atari bought the license for this back when it was like, oh, Krull's gonna be the next big thing. This is gonna be huge, we better get on the ground floor of Krull. And then they're watching the movie and they're like, oh my God, what are we going to do with this? Like, how do we make a game out of this? I don't know. And the spider web thing? Yeah, but that's not the main guy in the movie. I don't care. Like, that's the thing. It's the thing that looks like a game. Okay, so
Zookeeper was already invoked. And I'm curious what you guys think about this game relative to Zookeeper.
Oh, it's worse than Zookeeper by
easy. Yeah, I have a lot more fun with Zookeeper.
It's not as fast paced. Yeah.
Good sanity check. Okay.
Okay, well, let me drag out, because I love it. Knights of the Crystallion, which is a blown out insane person in terms of combining a bunch of things together like a madman.
There's another game where you play it and you're like, I don't know what this is supposed to be, what I'm supposed to be doing, who I am. I can't describe this to anyone. You gotta wonder, like, some of these games are so abstract and weird. Like, if they had like hotlines to call, like the Nintendo hotline, like, all right, I've got a problem with Krull. Okay, tell me what's your problem. Well, I'm on the thing that's like just a bunch of lines. I think it's a spider web. Oh, you're on the spider web stage. Yeah. And I'm trying to get to the glowing white rectangle. Is that the goal? Or, yeah, that's the goal.
I got to say, I do.
Just based on your description, Knights of the Crystallion might be in the same universe as
Wow, that makes sense, actually. Well, I got to start a fanfic now.
Yeah.
Knights of the Crystallion might be like a pseudo sequel to Krull for all we know. Like, they seem.
Wait. Knights of the Krullstallion. How about that?
What about Octopus? Is it better than Octopus?
No. Octopus? No, it's not better than Octopus. Octopus is a game that makes sense, and it's, look.
Yeah. Just for the spiderweb sequence alone, Octopus is probably better. That's,
yeah, it's not like Octopus is like has a current that's constantly dragging you to the edge of the screen.
Yeah.
I mean, am I correct in that
Krull is
basically several other games kind of mashed together into its separate screens? Like, essentially, it is like, you know, like, first stage is very Space Invaders E, and then I don't know where the spider's stage is from, and then the last stage is
compared to the other crap on the market at the time, it's maybe impressive because it's like four kinds of crap.
I'm looking at E-SWAT, and I'm thinking about E-SWAT, because, like, basically, I think E-SWAT's great until you get into the E-SWAT suit.
I think you're crazy for thinking that, just,
That suit is terrible and looks like shit, but E-SWAT is a really good game otherwise.
Are you talking about the suit in the arcade game or the Genesis game? Because the arcade game suit looks worse than the Genesis suit.
Look, man, again, I like E-SWAT, and I like the Sega Genesis, and I am one to be a fan of E-SWAT, but that suit is dumb.
I like it. Like, it's so dumb, man. It's like Krull.
Krull is pretty dumb, but like that, I don't think it goes too much farther below E-SWAT. Like, it's okay, that's the range of it.
So when you get down to this territory, just to give the listeners an idea of where we are here, which is a phrase I've said so many times, that if there's ever a Xerxes action figure, you know what's going on the back of the it's one of the buttons on my shoulder blades is going to say
click.
But
I would say
you're down in the territory of stuff that is like, it was a valiant effort, I guess, could be like the name. So you're down in we've got Technocop, E-SWAT, Road Rash, Haunting, starring Polterguy, Tale of the Sun, Riven, Nightshade, Live a Live, and so on. I think this is probably the right territory, because I do, although my point of about talking about the MASH game is just to say, like, you know, a lot of games from this time period were doing this, like, multiple screen, like, let's see whatever, you know, like, we'll give the kids all the games, you know. So that was normal, but I do feel like Krull is more playable, in a sense. Like, MASH isn't, in a way, they're, like, tighter, more focused games, but they're not quite as...
I think Krull's pretty fun. If you had gotten this game, yeah, when it came out, you wouldn't have been disappointed. You'd be like, yeah, this is fun. I like it.
Can you imagine, a 12-year-old kid excited about the film Krull getting this game?
I can remember being a 12-year-old kid who was excited about the movie Stargate. So, yeah, pretty much.
God bless you, Xerxes. I pitched this right between E-SWAT and Road Rash.
Okay, I'm okay with that.
I'm going to have to put it below Road Rash because there's nobody on a motorcycle with a giant chain whip.
You know what? I agree.
But yeah, you don't but get you the blame.
How what?
But you're bringing your knowledge of the movie into the game. In the game, there's...
You can be a man who jumps over a white line.
And you're going towards a glowing rectangle.
Yeah, but you do get the glaive. The glaive is on the screen and you throw it and it bounces. You get that. You do?
Okay.
That's
true.
You can stab a bunch of aliens who shoot laser buskets.
I will say straight, like, I find the, you know, like, the 2600 stylings, they do tickle my fancy a bit. I like the, yeah. I like that insane degree of abstraction. This game has gorgeous 2600 style rainbow effects where things just palette cycle, like, vertically. It's, you know, it is whacked out. But
the Beast's Castle looks dope in this game.
It is a cool, like, this game, you know, there was a lot of effort, but, you know, Road Rash, I'll give it, you know, it is, you know, it's pretty good. It's not Road Rash 2, but it is, it's decent.
I mean, the good thing about Road Rash is that it sells itself on the concept alone, whereas Krull, you have to have the Krull name such as it is backing it up, I guess, because otherwise you're kind of like, I don't know what this is. Yeah. Also, the thing about Krull is it's got that opening stage, which I think, Jeff, you just acknowledged, serves no purpose other than to
really
build up the score and does nothing.
Yeah, it's a...
It's an inscrutable cipher of a gameplay scenario.
If they hadn't have included, like, that, you wouldn't have been able to follow along with the story of Krull.
Yeah, it wouldn't motivate you to go back to...
Empire Strikes Back, Atari 2600 game. One of the best Atari games ever. One of the best Atari movie games ever, easily, if not the best. And it is one segment of the movie. It's like 20 minutes of the movie at most.
But it's the right one.
But it's the right... It's the most gamifiable part of that movie. There's not, like, a separate level where after you beat, like, the giant Imperial Walkers, then they're like, I'm going to balance stones with this Muppet kind of level. You know, there's no... It just does the thing. There's no, like, kissing your sister minigame.
There's no sitting at back to tank minigame.
Yeah, like...
Help me, Dr. Roy.
Right, exactly.
Let's say if Krull was just the only had, like, the beast fight, that was the only stage it had, would it have been better, would you say? Because I don't think so.
But that to me is just an indictment of the game.
Yeah.
Like, it's four lesser games when it should have just been one good game.
It's really more like three, because the side-scrolling horse riding is more of an intermission than a game.
Yeah, like, I'm sitting here being able to write off about half this game as bad, the first scene as pointless, and the fourth screen as kind of unnecessarily obtuse and difficult and requiring dumb luck in aforementioned screens. So,
and the game is like 8 bytes.
Yeah. You
know, it's like nothing.
Okay. I can concede this going under Road Rash and above Haunting starring Polterguy, if for no other reason than it breaks up a solid block of three at Silent Fanatic nominations.
Okay. All right. Yes. True. We don't want to encourage that guy. No, he's great, but yeah. It's important to acknowledge what other people have already said, which is that in terms of the absolute tidal wave of dreck that was the 1983 offerings for the 2600, this goes below every game Activision published that year. But, you know, I mean, it's not E.T. You got to give
and
it
E.T.
that.
E.T. is in a bunch of other actually significantly worse games. I mean, the basement of Atari 2600 games is a place you do not want to go.
This kind of is the basement, too. E.T. was an 82 game. Like, at this point, the bottom had fallen out. Like, I think that this game is as good as it is kind of impressive in its own way, because in 1983, like, this was like the home consoles are basically dying in the United States in this year.
Yeah, well, I mean, even Atari as a publisher or developer, rather, is this is just about the point where their new talent that arrived after all the good people left and formed their own companies where they'd make actual money and get credit for what they did.
Yeah.
This is the point where their new talent is starting to understand what the hell they're doing. That, you know, that's a thing, and that's good.
I do want to sign off that this game, you know, it does, you know, as much as, oh, it's four disconnected or whatever scenes, you know, it does feel a little bit like a, you know, like a story, a little bit like a quest. Like, it does manage to feel that, and I think that's nice. You know, you do have the stages, like, okay, this is part of the journey. This is the adventure that Kroll goes on. It's not completely disconnected. You actually do feel like, you know, the woman, I don't know the name of the character in it, gets kidnapped. You got to find where the villain is. Then you go to his tower and you beat him up. I mean, that's, you know, that's connected. It's pretty good.
To tie it all the way back, like, it does feel very, very vaguely like a specifically like advanced Dungeons and Dragons era D&D kind of thing. You go on a weird fantasy sci-fi adventure. It's just not on a PC. It's on a 2600, and they did what they could.
Okay, so Bobinator has already updated the list, which means it's done.
Great.
He's like, stop
it. I hold the true power here.
So Kroll for the Atari 2600 goes right underneath Road Rash, right above Haunting, starring Poltergeist. And thank you, Jeff. I don't think I would have ever played Kroll if not for this. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Third Wave Water. Several years ago, I had the chance to live in Italy, and that's a nation that's rightfully proud of their espresso. While I was there, I learned that one of the reasons their coffee tastes so good is because of the mineral content in their water, and probably their pipes. So that means that even if I use the same coffee, the same machines, and I did it at home, my espresso would taste a lot worse than theirs because I don't have the same water. My tap water is disgusting. Your favorite coffee shop knows this, which is why they've spent thousands getting their water just right. And thanks to our friends at Third Wave Water, you can work that same magic for yourself for as little as 10 cents a cup. Their patent-pending blend of minerals brings out your coffee's natural acidity and sweetness. I've tried Third Wave Water for myself. It's super easy. I just opened a gallon of purified water, poured in a tiny little packet of minerals, swished it around a little, and used it in my perfectly normal, not particularly fancy coffee maker. And the difference was obvious. The same coffee I always use, but I don't know how to describe it. I guess I would say the flavor is clearer. You know how the side of the coffee pod boxes have all those little flavor notes? I felt like for the first time in my life, I felt like I could actually taste that stuff. So if you want to support the show and dramatically improve the taste of your coffee, check out thirdwavewater.com and use promo code HARDCORE for 10% off your order. That's thirdwavewater.com, promo code HARDCORE.
In the year 2027, the American Congress passes a poorly worded bill that inadvertently renders all video games illegal. Within 3 days, the entirety of the United States of America collapses into a post-apocalyptic hellscape. But for those of you lucky enough to live in the past, there's
still time to donate to the Hardcore Gaming 101 Patreon. So give now, and ensure that the only thing keeping you awake late at night
is the ever-present threat of Mecha Hitler's cybernetic human extermination squads.
It's nice to have peace of mind.
Okay, the next game we're talking about is Sonic the Hedgehog 3 and Knuckles, which was nominated by at Robert Nader. That's you, Bob. It was developed
that's
by Sonic.
A jerk to me.
No, he's a great guy. Follow at Robert Nader on Twitter. It was developed by Sonic Team and published by Sega for the Sega Mega Drive, Sega Genesis. Earliest release date and territory was February 2nd, 1994, in the United States.
With Sonic and Knuckles coming out a few months later, that's probably the first thing we should talk about. This game kind of got a weird release. So first you had Sonic 3 that came out at the date we just listed, and a few months later, they had Sonic and Knuckles. And the weird thing about Sonic 3 is that the cartridge had a slot in the top of it that you actually had to put the and Knuckles cart in to get the entire game. There's pretty much no other Sega Genesis game that does that ever.
Yeah, I mean, it's like to describe it to people who aren't used to thinking about the physical presence of cartridges.
Yeah.
Like, imagine a Mega Drive cartridge that has, like, a sort of... It has a second pin connector on the top of it. So it's got a female pin connector on the top and then the normal male pins on the bottom. And so you would plug it in and then you would stick the Sonic cartridge on top. And it worked a lot like the, you know, like a Genesis or Super Nintendo Game Genie, if you remember those. But why would you, anybody who remembers those would know how this worked anyway. I guess the Genesis is sort of legendary for having a lot of expansion type things that you could put into it at once. There was a couple experiments done. I recall seeing one. There's, of course, the legendary Genesis Doom Tower, which is like every conceivable Genesis like cartridge plug-in peripheral stacked on top of each other. And it's like 3 feet tall, you know, like a meter tall almost, or at least it looks like that in the photos. It's ridiculous. You know, it includes like the 32X, the Sonic and Knuckles thing, like probably a Game Genie in there, a power base converter, the Master System thing. And then another thing, I saw somebody who just like had a bunch of Sonic and Knuckles cartridge things and just stacked them on top of each other and just counted how far you could, how many times you could layer them on top of each other before the game became unplayably glitched out. It was kind of surprising. I think it was a couple of them. There's more than two.
Does it just become Sonic and Knuckles and Sonic and Knuckles and Sonic?
That would be so cool, right? Recursively. It's like in Being John Malkovich, where John Malkovich goes into his own mind, and it's just like a bunch of John Malkoviches.
So, yes, so lock-on technology. Bob, why do they need to create an expansion with the second half of a game on it?
Well, the thing is, you look up Sonic 2, do a lot of research, you'll see it was kind of rushed. You'll see there was like a whole bunch of things they wanted to put in the game they couldn't. So, and then Sonic 3, instead of just rushing the game again, just cutting out a bunch of stuff, what they did is they made like an entirely separate game that you had to put into it to make it the entire complete experience. And I don't really mind that idea, because really, the options were either like just cut out a bunch of things, which wouldn't have been any good, or delay it, and Sega couldn't do that because they wanted this game to make a lot of money right away. So I think they did the best option they could have given the circumstances.
What exactly does it add, for those who don't know?
Sonic and Knuckles adds about 6 new zones. That's about 12 or so levels, I think. And it adds a new character, Knuckles the Echidna, who has a bunch of new moves and also has some alternate routes that Sonic can't do. And that adds a lot of content to the game, enough that it's definitely worth playing over again. This game is also kind of harder, so it's kind of neat to have like a difficulty selection in there, I'd say.
Yeah, there's so you can play as... You could play the game normally as Sonic, and then you can also have the choice of playing as Knuckles. He doesn't resemble any animal I've ever seen. His thing is that he can glide kind of like a flying squirrel, right? If you touch a wall while gliding, he will latch onto it, and then you can climb up the wall.
He can walk through rocks, which opens up a lot of different routes, and I always thought that was really cool.
Oh, I didn't know that. He could walk through rocks? Like, he doesn't have to be running, or...
No, you can just walk right through them.
Huh. I didn't notice that when I played it. So it's kind of interesting because it sort of addresses one of my, not, I don't want to say criticisms, but kind of one of my regrets about the classic Sonic games, which is that the levels are actually pretty fun to explore, but it's really hard to do it as Sonic because like a lot of times if you fall down, you know, one of the strata of the levels, like it's sometimes you can't really get back up and get back to where you were to like check out what's up there. And also just the game kind of is really just trying to propel you forward. It really wants you to keep moving, which seems like kind of a waste in a lot of ways because there's, you know, the level design is pretty cool and there's like stuff around, like secrets to find, and it would be kind of fun to explore. And as Knuckles, it's a lot easier to do that because you can climb up the walls, and there's a great insight into like what the game was sort of missing. Like if you're going to add a character, have him be, you know, do something that would allow you to kind of play the game in a different way. And that was pretty cool.
You've also got Tails. He can fly, but the trade-off is you can't get the full ending of the game, so that's kind of a... I guess you could also basically say Tails is easy mode.
He just feels really slow, too. Like, I don't enjoy playing as Tails really at all.
Yeah, me neither. Sonic.
I hate his walk animation as well. He has this, like, dopey goose-stepping giant shoe thing going on. I can't take Tails seriously. Yeah, yeah, the rest of the game is so serious, like it's a solemn affair, as you're like loop-de-looping and whatever.
So What else does Sonic 3 and Knuckles, or should we just call it Sonic 3 and just consider the and Knuckles being the complete game?
Yeah, that
game?
Works, just to save us a few seconds.
All right. So what else does Sonic 3 add to the Sonic formula besides Knuckles?
Well, one thing I think is really cool is you got these different kinds of shields that you can find. Like, there's different elemental shields, and if you're playing as Sonic, each of them do different things. Like, you've got the lightning shield that lets you double jump, the fire shield gives you, like, a forward dash. I guess they're kind of like the equivalent of Mario's power-ups, and I'd say they do kind of add a lot. I think they're all pretty fun.
Get in, like, what gameplay scenarios do you want to have those different...
Like, all the shields do different things. Like, if you have, like, the bubble shield that you can breathe underwater forever, and that's really useful in a lot of situations. The lightning shield makes you immune to lightning, and there's also situations where that's very useful. And it attracts rings to you if you get close to them. That's pretty helpful, too. So, like, they're kind of situational, really, but if you're in the right situation, they're a huge help.
So this is our first, and is there, what's the new gimmick for Sonic 3? I forget. Like, after, like, so Sonic 1, like, the cool thing that I remember as a kid was, like, oh, the loop-de-loop, that's so cool. And then that becomes, like, passe really fast. And then Sonic 2, you've got, like, the weird corkscrew things. That's, like, the new cool thing. What is it in Sonic 3?
Well, the neat thing is that pretty much everything in Sonic 3 has some kind of neat thing to do. And that's what really makes it enjoyable for me is, So, what's neat about the level is that each of them has their own different thing, several unique different things that really set them apart, and that's something I really think is cool. Like, even the first level, you've got, like, a giant tree you run around a loop-de-loop on, kind of a 3D effect. You've got
You actually kind of, like, run around it like a centrifuge, right? Like, going up the inside of the tree.
Right.
It's pretty cool.
And you've got the boss's island on fire, and I always thought that was, like, the coolest thing when I was younger, because you've got an entire level, like, the entire jungle's on fire. Some you didn't see in Sonic 1 and 2 at all.
The fire shield blocks that boss's damage, so it's cool stuff.
You know, I'm not the most Sonic-literate human being on the planet, but just going through the chunk of it I did playing it for this podcast, I guess the insta-shield or, like, the kind of spin attack you've got that I think is new to Sonic 3. That is actually a pretty cool little thing. Like, it feels like I'm enjoying boss fights a lot more than I am even in the original Sonic, where it was a little more, I mean...
Yeah, you get, like, a little bit of extra margin of error, because you're like, all right, now I activate my little extra area of effect, and it lets you knock the bosses around a bit more.
Yeah, and it's kind of vaguely sin and punishment-esque in that way. Just like I have this kind of quick dodge or evade kind of thing, only you're just kind of temporarily shielding yourself. I don't know. That feels good.
I'm not sure if Sonic Mania includes it. I think it does, but it's kind of a...
I think I like that for some reason. There's a new thing in there now.
But it's a shame that this is essentially the last 2D Sonic for the, you know, Sega Mega Drive, whatever. And so they kind of ditched that shielding technique, I think, for a lot of the games after it. It didn't become a mainstay, that double jump error of effect. Sonic gets, like, you know, a lock-on in 3D and things, but it's not kind of the same thing. It feels very easy mode for bosses, I guess.
Yeah,
the only other gimmick I recall being added to Sonic in, like, the 2D-esque games are, I think, in Sonic Colors, you have, like, this weird, like... air dash type thing. Am I remembering that correctly?
They've got the whiffs things that let you do different powers.
Sonic Rush gives you, like, some weird air dash because it's called Sonic Rush, and Sonic is he can't stop running. If he goes below 50, he explodes, or whatever the context of that
Rush
game
is. For putting in the boost thing that's very divisive among Sonic fans. You just hold down a button, you just go fast, you just kill everything.
So yeah, Sonic 3, the levels are, they're pretty clear when you're supposed to go fast, I think. The first level, it's got, you know, open bits, and then you've got clear platforming segments where you go side to side. You know, Hydro City, you know, it's really obvious when you go down those really cool, like, ramps and, you know, all of the...
Oh, the water slides are so much fun. It's, like, pretty much, like, the best water level in any Sonic game, easily.
Yeah, so you've got all of that, and then, you know, you're underwater and stuff. You're like, well, obviously I don't run fast underwater. That's the... Sonic doesn't handle water very well. And then you get the cool... Cool stuff in Marble City, where you now get the weird flying topsy-turvy disc thing that Sonic gets access to for some reason, which gives you a shield. So you can go really fast on that thing, and you won't actually get hurt if you fall off it. You just go, ah, and then, you know, Sonic lands. I don't know how far you guys got in this fairly short game, Sonic 3 by itself. But
we're talking about Sonic 3 and Knuckles, of course. Let's not forget that. So we're
oh, yeah.
Which is arguably the complete game.
But that is actually quite a large game. Sonic 3 and Knuckles is a big game to get through.
That's why I'm so there's like a save feature that would really saves a game, for no pun intended, but it's really good that's there, because it is a long game, at least like a couple hours, I'd say.
Didn't Sonic 1 have some weird kind of continue code, or not continue code, but like level select or something like that?
Up, down, left, right, A start, I think, is the level select code for Sonic 1. I memorized that as a child, because then I didn't have to play Labyrinth Zone.
It's kind of
before
hard,
we get off the save system, can I just mention that this game has an absolutely gorgeous main menu saving loading screen? Like, it's so nice. It's this, you know, big, full, bright Sega style. Looks like the box art for the Japanese game. You know, it shows you graphically what level you were last at. It shows you which characters you were in. It shows you how many emeralds you've got. It's this cool sliding screen thing that, you know, you can... So if you play a Sonic only, you'll just see Sonic, you'll just see Knuckles. That sounds like stupid, but if you're comparing this to other games' save and load screens at the time, where it's like, do you want to load your game and it'll just have a name and maybe like a GUI that says you had 10 hearts? It's so nice. I loved that screen as a kid playing this game. I was just like, yeah, I'm ready to load my game. And I was really thrilled, because what I did with Sonic 3 was I finished the game. It's a Sonic 3, not Sonic 3 and Knuckles. This was before Sonic 3 and Knuckles was out. I played it, finished it as Sonic and Tails, then I finished it as Sonic, then I finished it as Tails. And so I had this graphical, you know, set of saved games where I'd finished the game on all these different characters. I thought that was nice.
I don't know if I'm going to go so far as to say the music is superior to Sonic 2's, but it is damn good late Sega Genesis music in this game pretty much throughout.
I mean, definitely instruments kick ass in this game. Amazing.
Yeah, like...
It's really hard to talk about this game because there's sort of... Before we rank it, I feel like we got to talk... Is this the best of the three classic Sonic games? Or the four, I guess, counting...
Most people I've asked say yes, but I've heard differing opinions on that.
Because I have a differing opinion.
I'm not really qualified to give an opinion.
I think you played Sonic CD, I think, didn't you?
Well, I was going to say, I played all four games. I just don't know whether I like Sonic enough to really that my opinion matters, I think.
Yeah, I've like touched all four of them I've not beaten any of them to date. The thing that I personally get hung up on with Sonic games is I don't really enjoy playing as Sonic and moving around with him. I don't know how else to put it. You can get it done, and I can appreciate the work that went into level design of these games. But wandering around kind of aimlessly in giant labyrinthine levels with Sonic is not something I particularly enjoy. And on that basis, I like would put CD below this. That game has fantastic music and looks really good, but it's just wandering around aimlessly. I don't know. I did not enjoy my time with it.
I know this in the game we're discussing, but I do kind of like CD a good bit. I kind of like how you have like to figure out how to use levels most efficiently to get maximum speed. Like, there are ways to figure out how exactly what you're supposed to do and puzzle out how to get the best times. So that's something I do appreciate. It's not quite as straightforward, but I feel it's a little bit more rewarding.
I mean, so if we look at the Sonic games and why Sonic 3 & Knuckles is not quite probably my favorite, is when I got it, I had Sonic 3, and I got Sonic 3 pretty much when it came out. And then I didn't really own Sonic & Knuckles. I got it maybe a year after Sonic & Knuckles actually came out, you know, really late towards the, you know, Genesis Mega Drive lifespan, you know, just when the PlayStation was coming out. I actually bought my copy of Sonic & Knuckles from a video shop, if anyone remembers those. I know, it's an old joke, but yeah, they let go of their entire Mega Drive inventory, and I bought Sonic & Knuckles pretty cheap, which was a good deal for me. I love Sonic, so... that was like, yeah, finally, I own this one. Because I think I borrowed it off a friend before that. But you know, by the time I got around to playing, I was like, this is actually... It is quite long, and... I don't know, it feels longer altogether than Sonic 2. So by the time... If you try and do it in one sitting, you know, you really... I do feel like you tail off, like, by the time you get about, you know, two-thirds of the way through the whole thing, or even three-quarters of the way, you're like, I really need to take a break. I can't play any more of this. Whereas Sonic 1 and 2, I feel, both of those games, they do force you to in a sense, because you can't save. Right. You do have a level select. But you can sit through, and I think like those are, yeah, you can fit one of those into a gaming session. Especially Sonic 1. You know, you can really get through Sonic 1
in one session. I feel like Sonic 2 gets a little bit too long near the end, especially in the, like a three-act zone that just kind of stretches on for a long while.
That was definitely, I think, Metropolis was the weakest zone in Sonic 2, but because it was way too long. But I guess at least it's memorable, a god-awful zone of nightmares. But I don't know, like, I think Sonic 3 has a lot more gimmicks in it, and that was because Sonic 2 kind of, in many ways, perfected 2D Sonic in a lot of ways. It was like, yep, that's all we need to do. We're done. We did it. It's got great music, great levels, great design. Don't need any more. And so Sonic 3 was like, all right, well, we have to sell more Sonic games, so let's gotta put more shit in it, because we have to sell more Sonic games. And is it a bad game? Of course not. But it does start to feel like it's getting bogged down to me outside of what the core of the game is. Is that a bad thing? No, not exactly, but it's also...
I can see why they kind of stopped making Sonic games after this, because you couldn't really go anywhere else from here for a while.
Yeah, I think they really struggled to do it, and I think part of the problem is that Sonic 3 doesn't feel like it has some of the most interesting zones. Like, okay, so Sonic 2 has Casino Night Zone, and I'll talk about the zone for a billion hours. but that's a super exciting zone that I think is inarguably one of gaming's best levels. And I don't think Sonic 3 kind of has that, where it feels like, ah, this is why I'm playing Sonic. This is why I'm playing as this hedgehog. It's just like, oh, okay, this is... I get it. He's going fast. He's doing lots of nice tricks and things. Am I using Sonic in some unique way that another video game protagonist can't do? And it's like, no, probably not. Like, he does loop-de-loops and stuff, but it just doesn't feel as, I guess, innovative as like, incredibly interesting. It's just like, wow, this is a polished, great game. Is it as good as the other one, which feels, I think, slightly more Sonic?
You know, four classic Sonic games. I think even, you know, if you were to rank them top to bottom, I think whatever you put in that fourth spot is still a pretty good game on the whole. Sonic games are not bad. I think there is a spectrum of taste of things that people can tolerate within the franchise itself, but they are not poorly made things. I think they've got... Comparing Sonic and Mario just seems kind of pointless in a way.
I'm just going to say that at this point, Mario wasn't really a thing for another year, so I'd say the only really Mario game you really compare is a Sonic 1 with Mario World, and then Mario kind of took a break for a little while, so Sonic was kind of doing its own thing by that point, I'd say.
Well, I think Sonic was doing its own thing in Sonic 1.
Right.
That's kind of the whole point. Like,
so, yeah, I mean, because they were, you know, the mascots for the two respective consoles, and like the pretty much the only real competitive console war that's ever happened, I think, really. If you want to be real about it, like ever since then, it's just always been like one console dominates the others, and that's it. Except I guess maybe like with the Wii, because that sort of outsold everything, but then people stopped playing it. Anyway, the point, like because of that, there's like this kind of false dichotomy between the two game series, as if like Sonic is the answer to Mario, and like no, the whole point of Sonic the Hedgehog is that it's not Mario. It's not trying to be. It's not going to try to do that. It's going to try and do something really different, and it did, and it succeeded on its own merits. But the idea that you have to compare the two games to each other is ludicrous. They're not the same. They don't even have the same goals, I think. Like with Super Mario World, I think the goal was like, let's do Super Mario Brothers 3, but let's make it a lot bigger and really kind of show off the hardware and just pack it full of content and stuff to do and, you know, good level design and all that. Whereas with Sonic the Hedgehog, at least with Sonic 1 especially, it was the idea is like, let's do something new. You know, let's do something that is as different from Mario as we can make it while still being a platformer. And that's probably its greatest strength, is it succeeded where pretty much most other mascot platformers fell flat on their ass.
And you know, it's interesting. I mean, since unfortunately we're not talking about Sonic 1 here because Sonic 1 is very close to the first, I think, true 16-bit platformer. It feels like a whole shift from 8-bit. Just the way the levels are huge, the way the, you know, the motion is there, everything feels kind of just impossible to do in the previous generation. So Super Mario Land didn't feel that way, you know. It's like Super Mario World, sorry. It's like, yeah, you could do most of this. It's just newer.
I don't know.
But we're talking about Sonic 3 and Knuckles.
Well, okay, but we're talking about, like, because we have to move on to ranking it, and there's no escaping the fact that the top of our list. So I mean, I'm not a huge Sonic fan. In fact, I actually kind of find the classic best versions of the game, of the franchise, kind of irritating in a way. But I try not to, like, when we're discussing the game, I'm not going to hold that against it.
Can you tell the viewers and the listeners, more importantly, how you feel about Sonic the Hedgehog back when he came out?
Well, okay, so here's the thing. Yeah, so I am
this has to be prefaced by Xerxes is old as shit.
I used to have a little song to play under this part, but like the Little Rascal song or something like that. The thing is, I'm just old enough to be a part of that target market when Sonic was introduced as a character, as a game. And I remember being just old enough to be like, well, this is just lame. Like, this guy's like, he's like a, you know, he's trying to out attitude Mario or something, like to out 90s everybody else. And I just felt like it was, to me, that's like, at the time, it was like the same kind of trend I was catching with, like, you know, what was happening to just about every other, like, legacy character that was being updated, you know, the poochification. Like, to me, Sonic is like Poochie, basically, from Itchy and Scratchy and Poochie episode of Simpsons, where it's just like he's like a mascot kind of guy, but Rastafied by 20%, you know. And so to a degree, I think that it'd be hard to argue that that's not the intention. I think that they were definitely trying to do something that was like cooler and like more 90s or whatever, more attitude.
Of course, the early pitch was he was like a cool band guy and he had a backing band and stuff, right?
Hey,
like,
yeah, it's insane to think they actually mellowed out the calmer version of this concept, wound up being a blue hedgehog with red sneakers who runs fast and eats chili dogs.
Right. Like, but he's like, you know, he's like impatient with you. If you put down the controller, he's like tapping his foot and like looking at you like, you old man, you, why don't you just hurry up and die of oldness? Because I've got places to go.
I did want to like make a
neon to wear. So the, you know, I mean, to me, that was just what it was. Like, it was, but the thing is like, although I will swear to the grave that is still Sonic to this day, is that like, he just keeps getting more toed and more toed and more toed as it's like, you can't, so I don't like that, but
I do want to say,
and I didn't like that as like an 8-year-old or whatever I was or 10-year-old
like
or whatever
to
I was.
Say something real quick. That's okay.
Yeah.
What you're saying is partially part of the marketing more than the actual game itself, I'd say. I mean, if you look at the Japanese versions, they don't try to make him look as tootified. He's more cute, and I'd say that's not entirely the fault of the game that he's presented that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. I mean, like I said, he does tap his foot, and he is, like, you know, giving you, like, the DreamWorks face on the title screen. I mean, that's in every version of the game. And like in the Japanese, like they're the people who made the game, like the concept art and stuff, like he was going to have like electric guitars and like a Cuban girlfriend named Madonna and all, you know, I mean,
almost starts out as like a regular tier, like Sonic fan fiction, you know, start. It's just right. He's got a Cuban girlfriend and he's awesome and everybody likes him.
Here's the thing about Sonic that nobody wants to admit, well, I don't know whether anybody would. Even his detractors don't seem to catch on to, is that he was like self-insertion fanfic from day one. In fact, from day -20, because that was what he was. Like, he was there to like, and that was their plans. Like, he was like a power fantasy for like little kids. But the thing is you also can't deny that the character has survived despite decades of not so great games. You know, he had four really great classic games. And you know, since then there have been some good ones, some bad ones, and some really bad ones, and a whole really disturbing fan artwork. And
most of us want Sonic to be good, even when he's bad. Even people that don't like Sonic, they're not like, ha ha, another bad Sonic game, all according to plan. Yeah.
It's like, I think people working on this show generally kind of want everything to be good.
Right.
Games should be good. It's a problem when they are not.
Sonic's been there for so long that at this point, you know, it's like, even if you don't like him, you're like, Yeah, but maybe he should get a good game, because that'd be nice. You know, like, even when his games are bad, you're like, yeah, but I wish it was good, because Sonic deserves that. And this does have a sentiment to games like Sonic 3 and Knuckles, where it's like, yeah, it's pretty undeniably a really solid game, and even if you don't necessarily get it, you look at it and go, there is craft in that game.
Yeah,
there is
exactly,
so much.
Exactly. Yeah.
What really just annoys me, and this isn't something you guys are doing, I can't blame you for this, it's the people saying, oh, these new games are bad, thus all of these games must be bad logically, so, and that's kind of strictly untrue.
Unless we really want to talk more about, like you know, 9-year-old Xerxes and, like, feeling, you know, turning up his nose at Sonic the Hedgehog. Like, I will tell you, I can't tell you about what the experience was playing the game for the first time, because I felt like it was kind of lame in a way, but I was like, but the game looks so cool. Like, he's moving so fast, and he's doing the loops, and this has got to be so much fun, and it just drove me nuts that you play the game.
Did 9-year-old Xerxes mark out for blast processing?
Well, that was later. I was like, at that point, I was like, I played F-Zero, you know, every other person. And I was like, oh, this is nonsense. Like, who cares? But there is something about even the best original Sonic games that bugs me, which is that it seems like the point of the games is to go really fast, and that might not be the actual point of the game.
And, well, it's pretty clear when it's okay to go fast and when it's not. I don't think the game, like, tricks you or anything. At least that's never been my opinion.
There's a lot of, like, things where, like, you're like, I'm going fast, I'm going fast, I'm going fast, and, oh, no, I hit a spring thingy, and it just launched me into, like, a spike bed, you know, like, or there's, like, the spikes that just rocket out of the ceiling or something. It's like, it looks like the path is clear, but no, it kills you, it hurts you. And the good thing is that Sonic doesn't, like, they've got the whole ring health system thing, so that you always have a second chance. It's like, you can theoretically get, you know, chumpatized by all kinds of obstacles, and as long as you catch a couple rings before the next time that happens.
But that's what I mean by craft in these games, because, you know, if you have a look at Sonic clones, contemporary ones and modern ones, there's things like that they just don't seem to get. Like, wow, you know, Sonic has a really friendly system of damage, because you could get damaged pretty easily, especially if you haven't played it before, you don't follow the logic of the level properly, you know, like, you don't think like level designer thought, and you'll get hit. But a lot of these clones and stuff, like, yeah, but you can just have like 3 hits and you can collect more health in the level or something, whatever, we don't care, we're not paying attention.
If you want to understand what Sonic does right, you gotta look at the games that do it wrong.
But I don't want to. I want to know what it does right by playing the game that does it best.
Even though lots of games cloned Sonic, it's kind of strange, because platforming kind of eased off what Sonic, the Sonic style of platformer, after, I'd say, the 16-bit era, you know, after the sort of mascot 2D platformer died off, and then there was more of a surgence back into Mario-style platforming, like, if you know, if you're going to define a style, because, you know, that works better on pocket systems. Then that worked better on that sort of thing. So the Sonic style faded off, and this has causes big problems if you try and come back to a Sonic game after, you know, living on a steady diet of other kind of platformers.
I mean, I would say, like, you can look at kind of contemporaries of Sonic, or at least the later Sonic games, you know, the 16-bit era, and see, like, how the level design was influenced by Sonic in the worst possible ways. For the earlier version of this podcast, years ago, we played Home Improvement for the Super Nintendo, and that is, like, those are like Sonic style levels, except you're not like a super fast tude bearing hedgehog, you're like a dude with a nail gun,
and they typically make the levels too open. The thing about Sonic, and all the classic Sonic games do this, is they're kind of like funnels and pipes, basically.
That's true.
You get filtered to where you need to go, and then sometimes you can get into a pipe, and sometimes literally but sometimes figuratively, that will chuck you to different parts of the course. It's actually pretty linear once you break it down and you look at the
map. It always feels like there's like two planes of gameplay in each level. Like, you can make a mistake and fall down, and then there's like a second track down there. Then you kind of work your way back up.
There's usually between 2 and 3. Few levels have 3. Sometimes there's like transition points where you can get back up or get back down, or they meet in the middle.
Like we were saying earlier, is like the cool thing about Sonic 3 and Knuckles is that you've got the Knuckles guy who can not only has like the gliding ability, but the wall climbing ability, which really allows you to kind of explore and open up the levels in a way that I always felt like when I play the earlier two games, that I was like, I just wish I could just like go up a ladder Like, I would sell, like, my kingdom for a ladder just to go up one level and just... I don't want to have to bounce. I don't want to have to glide above fans. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, what Sonic does is it teases you. Like, if you fall off the top part of the level, it'll sometimes show you snippets of the part of them, and you're like, what if I was up there? I'll have to play the whole game again to get up there.
Yeah, and with Knuckles, you can kind of get back up there. Yeah. But it also allows you to reach play... You know, they can hide little things up there. And, of course... If you've got the Sonic, if you're playing Sonic 3 and Knuckles, that means you've got the little expander cartridge, which means you can go back and play Sonic 2 with Knuckles, right?
Yeah, so, but he doesn't get his powers. I'm sorry.
Oh, he doesn't?
He's regular.
I thought he could climb.
I thought he was just regular Knuckles. Maybe he can climb, but I thought it was basically just a sprite swap in Sonic and Sonic 2.
Lest we forget.
You can climb Gliding 2. I know for that for sure.
You can?
That are new. I mean, that's not, we can't really factor that in.
Well, but I mean, if we were to factor those cartridge fiddling around with that Sonic and Knuckles cart, if you stick Sonic 1 in there, you have to play Blue Sphere like over 100 million times, and Blue Sphere is bad.
I like Blue Sphere.
I know you do, and I respectfully disagree.
Blue Sphere than, I like Blue Sphere because it's not that half pipe. They love using that half pipe over and over and over again.
Jeff like
I'd like him to bring back Blue Sphere. The half pipe is great, and you can tell they keep bringing it back because it's great. But
the Blue Sphere is a part of like this thing where it must have been a subconscious thing at Sega, but like almost everything they put out at about that era on forward until they put out the Saturn looked like a Dire Straits video in some way, shape, or form.
I mean,
I don't.
It's a really cool technical trick that Blue Sphere is running on, like, effectively, like, late 87 hardware from an arcade machine. Like, that's cool.
It's really cool in that it's basically a playable demo scene piece.
Like a kind of roided up PC engine is what.
Like, it looks really cool, but I understand that basically turning happens on every one of the, like, corners that are drawn out on the grid. Like, yes, that makes sense. Get my head around it. In practice, like, just executing those turns feels, like, kludgy and alienating and not...
It sucks, fun. And the Genesis Mega Drive D-pad sucks.
Yeah.
Hey, so hey, I will fight sucks. You on that. IRL, let's go. You bring your SNES, and I'll bring my Mega Drive pad, and I'll spin it around my head, and maybe I'll put my
own will break first, I can assure you of that. Especially if it's the Mega Drive Model 3 D-pad. Those things were, like, made of, like, porcelain. God. Like, really, like, eggshells.
That Model 3 is such a fucking...
Is that the 6-button pad, or...?
It's no, the second version of the 6-button pad. Those things are, like, just shattered.
The Majesco Model 3 manufactured one.
Oh, they're terrible.
No, don't stay away from those. Those are...
So, we're dancing around this. We need to rank this game.
All right.
So, I want to preface this by saying that I had initially pitched a position, and after having poked the game for a little bit today, I have genuinely softened on it a little bit. A lot of it, frankly, comes down to that, like, not spin dash, but that kind of spin, evade, attack move, like, feeling better than I was giving it credit for initially. I would like to pitch an initial rank idea here, and that would be between Streets of Rage 2 and Alien Soldier. And I think that's pretty good.
A little more reasonable than last time, I'll admit.
It's a secret off chat negotiation.
I've also lowered my standards a little bit. I used to say below Pac-Man, but now I'm thinking below XCOM.
All right.
Above Super Metroid,
So I guess we need to find somewhere between
there. We're still going to be friends after this. This is okay.
Yeah, we can all disagree. As long as, yeah. Here's how I look at it, is that although I think you guys made a pretty good case for, or some of you guys made a pretty good case for Sonic 2 probably being the best classic Sonic game, for me, if there's one classic Sonic game that I'm going to play of the four, it would probably be this one, because I feel like you've got options.
I'm going to go even lower. I'm going to say below Shinobi 3, and that's my last offer.
Really? Really?
Below Shinobi? What are you doing? You psycho!
No,
crazy! Slow this guy down!
I'm trying to negotiate here.
That's weird.
Don't negotiate before they state their position. Don't you know how negotiations
really
work?
High. Now I have no reason to.
Yeah.
I did want to look at Shinobi 3 because that is, in a lot of ways, it's Shinobi 3, Sonic 3, and Knuckles. You know, like, I did think Sonic 3 and Knuckles was a little better than Shinobi 3, I felt, just in...
Me too.
In general, I think that that's, you know, it's a bit stronger.
I'm not a huge Sonic fan. I felt like it was better than Shinobi 3. I feel like that's selling it pretty short. I was going to put it... So it sounds like, ironically, I was going to have the highest ranking, although we haven't heard what Cal would say. But... I was going to throw it a bone here because I feel like just because here's the thing is like I'm coming at this with a bias, which is I don't really like Sonic games, but I admire them from afar in a way. Like I don't dislike them in a sense that like this is all garbage and people who like this should be ashamed of themselves. No, it's just like this isn't fun for me. Like I do see in a way, I guess that helps me see kind of some of the value in it that maybe is overlooked by all the, you know, erotic adventures that can be expounded upon and stuff like that. No, just kidding. I see kind of a little bit the craft that goes into this, and even though it's not my kind of game, I gotta say, like, I feel like Sonic 3 and Knuckles is the best classic Sonic game. It's the one I would want to come back to and play, even if I only can play it for about 25 minutes before I start getting a headache, because I'm old. And he's just got so much attitude. I just want to put him in a corner, make him do, you know, stay after school. I would put it right below Lode Runner, right above Devil May Cry. Lode Runner
Online.
That's
reasonable. I guess I could live with that.
I think because I'm just saying, like, in here's what got me there is that, as I was saying earlier, like, there really isn't any platformer that does what Sonic does, including new Sonic games. And I feel like this is the one that delivers the most value, the most, it's, you know, a big part of Sonic games in the old days was like the Gee Whiz effect, you know, like, oh, that's really cool. How'd they do that? It looks really neat.
You know,
and Sonic 3 is the best of the, you know, it delivers the most, 16-bit magic.
To be honest, I could see a few parallels between Devil May Cry and Sonic. They're both games about looking super cool and doing everything with a lot of style, but if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to get slaughtered.
Right. And it feels good, though, when you do it. Like, it feels like, oh, yeah. Like, it's satisfying. There's, like, a satisfaction to once you've mastered a stage in Sonic, it feels very good in a way that I think, like, mastering, a stage in Super Mario 3 or something like that just doesn't have the same effect.
Well, I did think, and this is something I didn't specifically say this until this point, but Sonic, as a franchise, and it is related to my point about the levels being, the game being a bit long, is that Sonic in some ways does feel like a racing game in that you sort of can approach the levels, you can try and hit like your par time, and you don't expect to be like, you don't expect to not bump into walls and stuff the first time you play through a track in a racing game. You know, like, you expect to have to learn the feel, learn, you know, kind of how it's laid out, what you're going to do to really, you know, push yourself further. And I think Sonic captures that really well, and one of the reasons it's very popular with speedrunners and stuff. I know they love the Sonic games. And that's not kind of just sentimentality for them. Like, I think some of the other speedruns are very sentimental, whereas these are like, they've got like lots of stuff that happens and you can really, I mean, those speedruns are crazy where they put themselves through walls and stuff, which is insane. One thing I did want to ask, because I don't know how, if we brought this up specifically, Sonic 3 and Knuckles is two games. You had to buy two games to get this experience, and I'm not sure whether that's fair or not to some of the other games where, like, we're comparing them at, where they were essentially one game. You know, the price goes up or down a little bit.
I just feel like looking back on it, like, at the time, yeah, that affected its value because it's like, I already paid for Sonic 3. Why do I need to pay for another game to get more Sonic 3 that should have been there in the first place if that's what they really wanted to do? But it was, you know, it was rushed out the door for whatever, you know, bottom line kind of reason.
Project.
You know, man. Yeah, that's real. But now it doesn't matter because now you can play, you know what I mean? Like, now you're going to, like, you're playing this on like a, some kind of game, you know, Sonic game collection or something.
They're
like
actually
that.
Pretty adamant about not putting the lock on cart on a lot of collections. It's really annoying.
So weirdly enough, the virtual console, apparently, if you own all of the Sega Genesis Sonic games, there is a sort of weird lock on solution they've baked in for the Nintendo Wii, not included in Sonic's Ultimate Genesis collection, stroke Mega Drive collection. It's really, really fucking weird. But yeah, I think it's really strange how they've chosen to not really preserve this thing.
But that's Sega, and Sega, they suck.
Oh boy, Sega are the... Sega love to take a loaded gun and shoot themselves in the foot. Yeah. They're the best at that.
Yeah.
They're like taking... They've got this solid gold idea in character and IP. Like, a character who kids still know about to this day, despite never having played any of his games, except for maybe Smash Brothers.
They might have played Sonic Boom, the worst game he's released in a while.
And yet, kids still love Sonic. This is a solid, like, you can't put a value on this, and they consistently ruin it.
Yeah.
Like, they consistently, like, it's just like they're like, they don't want to succeed with Sonic. You know, like, just give it to somebody. You know?
They did. They finally did. They might have given it to someone who's going to make a good game. I don't want to be the bad guy here. I'm not sure if I'd put it above Devil May Cry, but that's me. Just
really,
me.
I cannot believe that the Sonic hater in the group, me, would put it higher.
I know.
Maybe I just,
right?
It's because I can't stand to play it long enough to really, like, see its flaws, but...
No, I love the game. I just also really love Devil May Cry. It's
such a precious thing because, in a weird way, like Sega has increased the value of the classic four Sonic games because there are so many bad Sonic games now, so many more like mediocre to bad to B minus type games out there that it feels like these are just precious, precious commodities that even a hater like me has to say, like, man, there's something cool here. But I just, you know, like I said, like, nobody did anything like this. There were so many platformers, mascot platformers that came after Sonic. Nobody came up with an idea as good as Sonic. Sonic is the best possible answer to Super Mario Brothers in the sense that they came up with a way of doing platformers that is completely different and is fun and is unique and has kind of an arcadey type aspect to it that fits with Sega's sort of reason for existence, you know. And I feel like Sonic 3 and Knuckles is the best version you're going to get of that probably ever. And for that reason, that's why I put it so high. So you guys can argue it down, but that's what I'm saying. Like,
no, I just wanted to hear you talk about how great Sonic was. That was worth the price of admission.
It's weird, right? Like, I don't really like the character and I don't really love the games all that much, but, you know, as a collector, I, you know, I don't have Sonic and Knuckles, but I do have Sonic 1, 2, and 3. I bring them out every time I bring out my Genesis, and I give them another shot. And some days are better than others, but
one day Sonic will click for you. I'm telling you, one day.
I don't think it will. I don't think it will. I think it's just it's.
You try
it's but you know, it doesn't matter because I'm this is an objective and scientifically accurate ranking, and so I'm just giving you, you know, this is what it means to me. That's how dedicated I am to my profession here.
I mean, if I had my own way, I would probably go like about like at least top five, but you know, we compromise here. We take what we
you don't
get.
Have to. You can just say like what's in your heart, like Sonic 3 and Knuckles is the best game ever made.
Well, I mean,
and
I think it would go above Super Mario Bros. 3 if I had mind control powers or something, but
why don't you just side with me then? And that's two against. And then they have to figure out where they go. Because if you side with me, you're still in the highest, you know, of the group of four here.
Yeah, I can work with you like on this. I'm okay with that.
Well, you all know, right. Like I'm not. That's two and two. I don't want to be the bad guy against Sonic. It's one of my
But now you are. Now
I know.
You are.
I know. You've somehow made me the bad guy.
I mean,
I own.
Where would you position it, Cal? Specifically,
he's put it. It's above Devil May Cry at the moment. That's where Sonic. Yep. 3 and Knuckles is Sonic 3
okay,
and
it's
Knuckles.
It's between Devil May Cry and what was Jeff's game? Turrican?
Yes.
No, he said between Alien Soldier and Streets of Rage 2, which is you know, these are all fine rankings for
so,
Sonic
yeah,
3.
Yeah,
I mean everything in the top like 50 games is pretty good.
Sonic 3 and Knuckles definitely represents a unique period of Sega and games as a whole. You know, just this sort of energy for producing these kind of 2D games with such an serious amount of like money and effort and time that they could pour into a dozen stages, which is kind of nuts to think about that they did that.
And
now
the music's great, and the animation's great, and the stage design is really good, if not the best that Sonic ever did, maybe. But it's really really good. You know, I mean, it's you know, the bonus stages suck, but you know, it's.
And I like the bonus stages, so that's, you know, I genuinely do like them. I enjoy
and
them.
And it's got the extra character who can do the thing that I always wanted a Sonic character to be able to do in a Sonic game, which is, like, just go up walls. And to me, that's a big deal. Like, that is what...
Sonic 3 and Knuckles is interesting because, to me, it represents Sonic, like, really understanding the direction he wants to go in. Like, yeah, this is right. We're getting there. We really worked it out. We knew how to make a good Sonic game. Here we go. Sonic Adventure, Sonic Heroes, Sonic fucking trash game. Like, wow. Yeah. Wow, the airbrushed Sonic 3 European box art on the van truck just flew right off that cliff after this game.
If you guys haven't seen the PAL Sonic 3 cover, please look it up. It's amazing.
Some of the best, worst, just...
I've seen better Sonic tattoos.
Yeah. I don't know if we deserve
it. I mean, Sonic just needs, like, some wings and stuff to really, you know, make it correct for
What kills me is he's holding up four fingers. I cannot fucking get over it. There's
guys, yeah, put it above Devil May Cry. I'm not going to push this. I can't push it down. I can't do it.
It's done.
It's done. It is written.
Well, I'm already writing it. Can't stop me. I'm doing it.
Hey, congratulations, Sonic. I'm going to stop the recording. Get better.
Yeah.
This is your year, man.
Yeah. Best of
Remember, everyone, watch Sonic Boom because it's way better than it ever should be.
And also, you know, if you're following Sonic's Instagram profile or whatever it is, good luck with that pregnancy, man. hang in there. Just one more month. That was interesting, huh, guys? Wow. Great. Episode 50. But you know what? There'd be more great content coming up if you were a Patreon donor. So if you were a Patreon donor right now, you'd be hearing us discuss a special bonus game, which is Altered Beast, the Sega classic kind of, I don't know what you'd call it. It's not really a beat-em-up, and it's not really Kung Fu Clone, but brother, well, it's got werewolves and, like, underwear and necromancy. I don't know. It's not bad. Not bad. But it's a great discussion, and you can only hear it by donating to HG101 on Patreon. So if you haven't done it yet, now's the time. Rise from your grave and donate. That's all for this episode of HardcoreGaming101.net's Top Games Podcast. Special thanks goes out to Nat Electric Viking.
And I guess that's how you pronounce
Robert
it.
Robert Nator. For nominating those games, and thanks as well to those of you we haven't gotten to yet. We will be getting to you soon. And thanks to my lovely co-hosts and compatriots, and to our editor Jeff Rude, and our theme song composer Muteki, our technical assistant and video editor Bobinator, and of course, thanks to the support and feedback of listeners like you. You can support this podcast yourself by making a small monthly donation at patreon.com/HG101. I know I did. And by subscribing to the HG101 YouTube channel, which is a great way to relive all of our amazing conversations from the past 49 episodes, and then eventually this one. And you can help us out by following at GT9X and at HG_101 on Twitter. But most importantly, help us claw our way into the podcasting firmament by getting on iTunes, subscribing to this podcast, and giving us a sweet, sweet 5-star review. Do it, or we'll lock you into a room and have Jeff talk to you about Krull, Gary Gygax, and Dune for 6 hours. Until next week, keep keeping it real.